Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. If you're an SDG&E customer, you may be in for a shock due to some rate changes just approved by the California Public Utilities Commission, and we'll have details. We'll also have news today about progress reportedly being made toward resurrecting the Desert Railway, once known as the Impossible Railway, through East County and Baja, Mexico. Also hear about a firehouse bond that Marty Emerald is working to get on the ballot in San Diego. Plus, we'll have an update on some key legislation in Sacramento. Our newsmaker interview today is Bruce Wilcox with the Imperial Irrigation District, who will be giving us a sneak preview of a proposal being unveiled soon aimed at saving the Salton Sea and why that should matter to people in San Diego and East County. Then on Destination East County, hear about some major festivals and events coming up across our region, including Descanso Days, Pine Valley Days, and a concert at a lavender farm. We'll also replay our interview with local author Paula Margulies on our bookshelf segment. So stay tuned for these stories and more on today's East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
This is Ed Barrena on KNSJ on the East County Magazine show, and I've got some shocking news regarding your power rates. Electricity bills will soon be going up for most San Diegans, though some heavy energy users' bills will go down. Instead of four tiers for energy use and payments, there will now be just two. Not only will low energy users and low income people be paying more, they will also be charged more for energy use during peak periods such as mid-afternoon. Those hikes come despite the fact that San Diego already has among the highest electricity rates in the United States. The new rates are the result of a dramatic change in electricity rate structures approved over the holiday weekend by the California Public Utilities Commission, or CPUC. It applies to customers of San Diego Gas and Electric Company, Pacific Gas Electric, and Southern California Edison. The action prompted the consumer advocacy group TURN, the Utility Ratepayers Network, to tweet, quote, "Toothless CPUC does exactly what it is told by PG&E, Edison, and SDG&E," unquote. The action narrows the rate gap between the state's smallest and largest energy users. Utilities have said that that gap is so wide that some Californians are now paying less than the cost of delivering their electricity. Michael Picker, the new chair of the CPUC, says the commission took the action to make sure rates are reasonable and fair to all California utility users, the San Francisco Chronicle reports. But ratepayer advocates and environmentalists say the action goes too far and is anything but fair, taking away incentives for conservation and even potentially having a negative impact on the thriving solar market. The public voiced strong opposition to the plan, while utility groups lobbied heavily in support. The commission's action will give relief to some homeowners who are in the upper tier and were essentially subsidizing neighbors who used less. Those who use the very most, four times more than the bottom tier users, will be hit with a surcharge, SDG&E has argued, that could benefit inland users who must run the air conditioning for long hours during summer heat. But the San Diego Union Tribune reports that that would aid a minority of just 2.5% of SDG&E customers. But for most everyone else, your rates will be going up, even for subsidized low-income customers. And even those drawing zero power off the grid will face a charge of $10 per month to stay hooked up every month, or $5 per month for subsidized customers. Hitting ratepayers up for higher payments during peak periods aims to reduce strain on the grid, since wind power produces most of its energy at night and solar shortly before midday. Michael Powers, co-owner of Stellar Solar in San Diego, told the San Diego UT that the action seems to run counter to the legislature's and governor's stated goals of making clean energy an engine of economic development. The CPUC action is making solar less and less affordable, he said, adding that if tax cuts for solar are not renewed at the state and federal level, affordability will be slashed even more.
Plans plans to revive the long-closed Desert Line freight railway from Campo to Imperial County had appeared to be in danger of derailing after the Pacific Imperial Railroad fell behind in payments to the Metropolitan Transit System. But now, the company has made its latest $500,000 payment to the Metropolitan Transit, the San Diego Union-Tribune reports. The 99-year lease requires two such payments annually. In addition, Pacific Imperial has announced an agreement that it has forged with Baja California Railroad to enter into talks about opening a binational railway. The Mexican company controls 44 miles of the line, which crosses south of the border and then back into the U.S. MTS awarded the lease to Pacific Imperial back in 2012, but the first management team hired drew controversy, including allegations that money from investors had been fraudulently paid to principals inside the company. The company denied this, and MTS reportedly found no evidence of fraud. However, that management team was replaced in early 2014. Major repairs are needed to get the Desert Line rolling. The Desert Line was once known as the Impossible Railway due to the many disasters that plagued it during construction, including the Great Depression, the Mexican Revolution, when workers left to join the insurrection, World War I that saw steel supplies diverted to the war effort, and the Great Flood of 1916 that sank an engine into the mud. Finally, on November 15, 1919, sugar mogul-turned-railway magnate John D. Spreckles drove in a golden spike in Carrizo Gorge, and 2 weeks later, a train rolled into San Diego's Union Station downtown, marking completion of the Pacific Coast end of the Transcontinental Railway. And soon, trains may be rolling down those tracks again.
In an interview with KPBS, retiring San Diego Councilmember Marty Emerald said she plans one final major action. My last campaign is a firehouse bond that will be on the 2016 ballot for November, she said. That would create a fund that can only be spent building fire stations. Emerald aims to have the bond fund construction of 19 new fire stations in addition to the 47 the city already has, though the initial process won't be complete till after she leaves office. Following the 2007 firestorms, Senator Dianne Feinstein convened a Senate hearing in San Diego at which criticism was leveled at city directors over the fact that San Diego failed to meet national standards for fire stations per capita. That gap became woefully apparent in neighborhoods such as Rancho Bernardo that suffered heavy fire losses. Emerald led efforts to improve public safety during her tenure on the council, which began in 2008 following a 30-year journalism career that included consumer affairs reporting at Channel 10 News. She was diagnosed with breast cancer last year, and though her doctors have reportedly given her a positive prognosis, she said the crisis has made her reassess her priorities in life. Recently remarried following the death of her first husband, Emerald has endorsed her chief of staff, Ricardo Flores, to fill her seat. Emerald also championed workers' rights, winning a major victory for taxi drivers and immigrants in District 9, which includes some of San Diego's most diverse communities, such as City Heights. She previously represented a district that included inland communities such as Del Cerro and Allied Gardens before moving to District 9. Emerald has endorsed her chief of staff, Ricardo Flores, to fill her seat in the 2016 election. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on some key bills in the California legislature in Sacramento. Currently, 49 states have made lane splitting illegal. That's the practice of motorcyclists whizzing between cars along the edges of lanes to bypass slow traffic on freeways. Only California has no law on the books to ban this practice. A study found that of 5,000 rush hour motorcycle accidents, 1,000 of them involved lane splitting. Assembly Bill 51 sought to set guidelines, but would still keep lane splitting legal. But opposition from motorcyclists who want it to be completely legal with no limits put the skids on the measure, which failed to win passage in this legislative session. However, the author, Assemblyman Bill Quirk, has vowed to try again next year. Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law Assembly Bill 258, which prohibits hospitals from refusing organ transplants to medical marijuana patients. The measure was introduced after some medical marijuana patients were reportedly denied life-saving transplants because doctors classified them as drug abusers. Americans for Safe Access estimates that over 1,000 Californians were at risk of being denied organs. Senate Bill 128, which would allow doctors to assist terminally ill patients who choose to end their lives, may be on life support itself. The measure passed the state Senate on a party-line vote, with only Democrats voting in favor and Republicans voting against. But it's expected to come up short of the votes needed to pass the Assembly's Health Committee, the Sacramento Bee reports. The bill would require that two different doctors confirm a terminal diagnosis of 6 months or less left to live. The patient would then have to make two requests for euthanasia support, 15 days apart or more, and self-administer the lethal dosages. A bill to require that employers give workers 3 paid sick days off each year has been signed into law by Governor Brown, and that measure was authored by San Diego's own Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Bruce Wilcox. Bruce is with the Imperial Irrigation District, and he is the manager of Environmental and Salton Sea Programs. And we're going to be talking about the threats to the Salton Sea today and why that matters here in San Diego County, what can be done. And he's going to be giving us a sneak preview of the brand new Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative that he's been working on. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about why the Salton Sea is so important and what could happen if it dries up.
Well, the Salton Sea is important for quite a few reasons. One of the biggest reasons is it's probably the most important stopover point on the Pacific Migratory Flyway for birds, and it's one of the last remaining stopover points in Southern California, so it's amazingly important from a wildlife perspective. It's also important from at least two other areas. The economic impact of the Salton Sea drying up, or portions of it drying up, is huge to the agricultural industry. The Imperial Valley and Yuma and Coachella Valley probably are the largest producer of winter vegetables in the United States. So certainly if we have a lot of dust that damages crops, that's going to mean a big difference to the cost of vegetables all over the United States. And then finally, there's the health concerns. As the playa exposes, there's going to be more and more dust. We have an air quality mitigation program that we're working on, but we still will have dust coming off of the playa, and that's a serious health hazard, both from an asthma perspective, lung diseases.
Yeah, and that playa is the salty desert crust, and it contains, you know, some chemicals from agricultural runoff and other things that we really don't want to be breathing in.
That's exactly right. It has some potential toxics and a lot of salt.
For those not familiar, the Salton Sea is due east of here in Imperial Valley in the Colorado Desert, in Imperial Valley, just next door here. And the lake was once 400 square miles. It's shrunk to about 250 square miles right now. And unless some drastic actions are taken, it could go away entirely. So, Bruce, can you bring our listeners up to speed a little bit on the history of this? How did this lake get started? It is the largest lake in California, and it is currently a saltwater lake. Tell us a little bit about how it got started and how we've gotten to where we are today.
Sure. Over the history, over the geologic history, there have been lakes in the valley. Those lakes have evaporated and formed playas. The Salton Sea Trough is one of those playa areas. In early 1900s, about 1905, when they first started irrigation in the Imperial Valley, one of the gates at the Colorado River broke and caused the Colorado River to discharge into the Imperial Valley for a couple of years, and that filled it up to the 400 square miles you referenced.
So it was a broken canal that caused the lake we now know as the Salton Sea today.
It was. You hear it called an accidental lake a lot, and I guess that's true, but the geological history would suggest that there has been water in that area as it has been dry.
So in the 1940s and 50s, this was really a thriving recreational paradise. It was a haven for boaters and fishermen and kids at play. There were resorts that sprung up. And of course, it was a wonderful wildlife habitat and even still is today, with hundreds of species of birds that are found out there. But then it's begun to dry up, and it isn't just due to the drought. Can you explain some of the factors at play here?
Sure. One of the reasons that the sea is receding is because of the quantification settlement agreement water transfer between the three water agencies, IID, San Diego County Water Authority, and Coachella Valley Water District. That was part of a settlement back in 2003 to get California to live within its 4.4 million acre feet allocation of Colorado River water. So in essence, that was a drought back in 2003. These were measures to control the drought, just like we're in now.
So as far as the role of San Diego, they were getting water from what, the Colorado River is part of that deal? Is that correct?
Yes, they get 200,000 acre feet of water from the settlement agreement.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ramped up yet.
And that's water that used to go to the Salton Sea, so they basically were diverting it. And in trade, what is the city of San Diego doing to help protect the Salton Sea?
Well, when the water transfer deal was cut, the three water agencies agreed to pay somewhere in the neighborhood of $370 million for mitigation. That mitigation included things at the Salton Sea, air quality issues, fish issues, habitat issues, and issues in the valley itself.
And that mitigation money runs out in 2017, correct?
The mitigation money probably runs out in about 2023 or 2024. The state of California is contractually obligated to fund the mitigation.
So to be clear, so the mitigation payments from these three water agencies ends in 2017, and the money will actually run out somewhere around 2022, 2023. And then what happens?
Well, the mitigation water stops at the end of 2017, and that's a mitigation measure. The money for funding mitigation measures that IID implements runs out sometime around 2023, 2024, and then the state of California is contractually obligated to pay the difference or pay the remaining of the mitigation. The reason the mitigation water was delivered to the Salton Sea to start with is because when the QSA was approved by the IID board and others, the state of California had made a legislative promise to restore the Salton Sea, and we assumed by 2017 that would happen. So
the depression or recession came along, and suddenly there wasn't a huge amount of money flowing into or out of the state anymore. So where are we now? I understand that you've told me there are three types of actions being taken to help save the Salton Sea. Can you tell us what those are?
Well, there are a combination of three different kinds of actions, I think. The first is just the mitigation that we're doing now, the delivering of water to the Salton Sea that is kept the salinity trends where they were supposed to be. The real enemy to habitat at the Salton Sea isn't the elevation change. It's the salinity of the water, and we're getting close to that now.
And if it becomes too saline, doesn't even have to dry out. If it's too saline, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of bird species that could just die out, right? There's no other body of water that they land on during their migratory path out in that vast desert area.
That's correct. It's probably the most critical link on the Pacific Flyway that in Southern California that we know of.
Okay.
And when we get to about 60 parts per thousand, the fish population won't sustain, so the piscivorous birds or the fish-eating birds won't be there anymore. The sea will still have some kind of ecosystem to it, but as it gets saltier and saltier, it'll be more like the Great Salt Lake.
Okay, so there's the short-term mitigation, which includes some air quality elements and so forth. What about number two, which is the Salton Sea Authority restoration, a little bit longer-term restoration proposal?
The Salton Sea Authority is a joint powers authority. IID is a member of this, mm-hmm. of that authority, along with a lot of other folks. And they're putting together what we would call a longer-range restoration plan for the entire Salton Sea. A couple things to keep in mind about that plan. One, it isn't funded yet, and secondly, it's going to have to be a smaller sea.
Yeah, the state, I understand, initially was talking about it would take $9 billion to restore the Salton Sea, and of course, in this economy, that's pretty unrealistic to expect to get out of the legislature. So tell me about what this smaller scale plan would include.
Well, the smaller scale plan that the Salton Sea Authority is working on will include some kind of marine lake or recreational lake of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
It will include habitat around portions of the sea. It will include a center brine sink. Most of the plans include that. And it's coupled with the third point, leg of the stool, I guess, for Salton Sea restoration, and that is the Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative.
We'll be talking about that very exciting prospect in a moment. But on the Salton Sea Authority, you've mentioned that it wouldn't take $9 billion that you're talking about. Instead of billions, you're talking about maybe tens of millions over some period of time, and that it could be done incrementally, correct?
I think that's the important part of this, yes. The getting a $9 billion bank fund isn't going to happen. So we need to look at an incremental approach. We can look at 10 million, 50 million a year for the next few years and build as much habitat as we can over that time frame. The other plans had a lot of berms in them across the center of the lake and other places that cost a lot of money up front. This way we can create habitat, deal with air quality issues in an incremental pattern over the next few years as the sea recedes.
Okay, now let's talk about what you've been working on that's going to be released, I understand, in the next couple of weeks. So listeners, this is a sneak preview here of the Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative. How much renewable energy potential is there in the Salton Sea area?
Well, there could be upwards of 2,000 megawatts of renewable energy, geothermal energy, around the southeast corner of the Salton Sea.
And that's huge. I mean, we're talking about other massive scale energy projects that don't produce a fraction of that much energy, where we're seeing, you know, vast tracts of desert, billions of acres being bulldozed or proposed for it, for say desert solar and wind and so forth. And you could do it in geothermal. How much land use does it require to produce that much geothermal power?
Well, typically a geothermal plant contains a turbine, and that's probably a 20 to 25 acre site. It contains 4 to 6 wells, which are 3 to 4 acres each, and it contains the pipelines to connect those wells. And the wells are usually not more than a mile or a mile and a half apart.
So much, much, much smaller impact on the land. Obviously, there's some. There's a little bit of light disruption at night and so forth, but nowhere near, it sounds like, the massive environmental damage that we've seen from not only what we see from, say, a oil-based power plant or gas-based power plant, but also huge land use from even some renewables, like the desert solar projects, for example.
Yeah, much less of an impact.
Interesting. So tell us some more about this. How important is it to develop this geothermal resource? What does that mean for not only saving the Salton Sea, but also for America?
Well, we think that renewable energy needs to be accelerated in California and across the United States. We have serious issues with the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere and just basic carbon. Geothermal plants are not completely non-emissive, but they don't have anywhere near the CO2 footprint.
So you think it's important to address the climate change or the CO2 emission problem?
I think it's very important. They're also what we call a base load power, and they don't have to have a backup generation of a natural gas plant or something else that produces even more CO2. And as we've already talked about, they're much more benign to the environment than some of the other
renewables. That's interesting, because over the weekend we saw the Public Utilities Commission approve a new energy rate plan that is going to force people to pay more for energy that's consumed during peak power periods like the afternoon. And the reason they gave is because, well, you know, as we're shifting to renewables, wind produces most of the power at night and solar peaks just before noon. But in that mid-afternoon, we want people to use less. So you're saying that if we got our baseline power from geothermal instead, that that would not be a problem?
It would be much less of a problem. There's always some balancing mm-hmm. that has to go on, but it would be much less of a problem.
It would certainly make the grid more stable, too.
It would.
Okay, very important. How compatible is geothermal power with wildlife in your experience?
Well, we have the Salton Sea Sunny Bono National Wildlife Refuge is out amongst the geothermal plants that have been built there already. Part of the initiative planning that we've been working on is to develop habitat air quality mitigation that fits in around the geothermal plants. It takes into consideration that there's going to be a geothermal well over on that side and a power plant over on that side and a pipeline that connects the two. And if you can imagine, the type of habitat we're talking about building is a series of berms that would be flooded with water. One of those berms would have to be built for the pipeline. So we've got some synergy between the two projects, less berms that have to be built for the habitat.
Very good. Now, besides geothermal, I also understand that your proposal includes taking a look at something called saline gradient solar. How does that work?
Well, we're kind of excited about that. And this saline gradient solar ponds are essentially an impoundment area of 20 acres with different layers of water in them. And each layer of water has a slightly higher saline content than the one above it. So the lowest layer is almost supersaturated saline. And it's denser because it's heavier. It's got the salt in it, and it stays on the bottom. The sun shines down through the upper layers and heats that bottom layer, and you extract the heat or the energy from that water and spin a turbine and generate electricity. They're almost like a solar battery. You could imagine you could let the sun shine on them all day, pull the power off at night if you needed it, pull the power off in the middle of the day if you needed it. Much less of an impact, we think, than some of the PV solar and some of those other programs. We're in the middle of experimenting with those down at the Salton Sea right now. We think they show a lot of promise.
Fascinating. Does it require very much water, by the way, for either the type of solar you're talking about or for the geothermal, for that matter?
Geothermal uses water, and IID has an industrial allocation of water for geothermal plants.
So that's covered.
That is covered. More geothermal plants, more water, though. I mean, there is a trade-off in all of this.
Yeah.
And the other piece from the saline gradient pond point of view is you could use seawater. You wouldn't have to use irrigation water for those. But one of the things we are looking at is how much do they evaporate because of the
heat. Can they use recycled water?
They could use recycled water. But I think we would probably look at recycled water as a better use for habitat, and then after it's used in the habitat, put it in the ponds. We have a finite amount of water to use,
yeah,
and we need to manage that in the ways we can and get multiple uses out of it by either the habitat. Each stage of the habitat will be slightly saltier or more saline, and different kinds of birds and different insects like those areas. And so you continue to use that water and cascade it from one to the next, then discharge it someplace else, and then discharge it to the Salton Sea.
That's all very exciting, Bruce. How optimistic are you that this plan could actually succeed, and what do you view as the chief impediments or potential impediments to it?
I am very optimistic that we will move forward with both a plan like this and a larger-scale restoration program. In the last year and a half, we've made a lot of progress towards that. And the IID board and our general manager have been very supportive. We've got a team of people working on it on our side that have done a lot of good work. I think the biggest impediment, and quite frankly, we don't have a choice. We're going to have to do something. The air quality impacts, if we don't do anything at the Salton Sea, are severe.
Yeah, and we should note that Imperial Valley already has some of the highest asthma rates in the nation. Childhood asthma rates there are staggering, and yet this could make it much, much worse and overflow. That same air would blow into San Diego County here as well as into parts of Arizona. So the potential scale of the harm is huge. I understand there's an economic dollar figure that's been estimated. If the Salton Sea were not restored, what would the economic impact be from all sources?
The Pacific Institute did a study about 6 or 8 months ago that suggested that the cost of not restoring the Salton Sea could be upwards of $70
billion. $70 billion. And that includes what? Lost tourism and agriculture and what else?
Lost tourism, lost property values, health issues, damage to crops. It looks at all the potential economic impacts of not restoring the Salton Sea. $70 billion.
Yeah, and then, of course, loss of hundreds of species of birds, priceless.
Absolutely. That's not, other than from a visitor point of view, that's not calculated into that. And to the point of the birds, we have lost most of the wildlife or the wetland habitat in Southern California and the interior of Southern California. So there isn't really a way to put a cost on losing the Salton Sea from the birds' perspective.
So this is critical from a wildlife standpoint. Bruce, where will this report of yours be released? We're talking about the Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative you're hearing a sneak preview of today. Bruce, where can people find a copy of that, and when will it be posted?
It will be posted sometime in July, and it will certainly be on IID's webpage.
That's the Imperial Irrigation District, and what is the website?
IID.com. And it'll be available there. We're also going to take it to the state of California. We've had some discussions with them already. It'll also be rolled into the Salton Sea Authority's plan.
What can listeners who care about this issue do to help assure that the Salton Sea will be preserved and restored?
Well, we've raised, I think, in the last year or so, the visibility of the Salton Sea has been raised a lot. And I think we need to continue that pressure. Folks need to talk to their congresspeople or their representatives. They need to come to Salton Sea Authority.
State legislators also?
State legislators and federal. The funding is going to have to come from both the state and the federal government.
Okay.
So there has to be a press, and people need to let their legislators know how important this is. We have especially on our side of the mountain, not as many people to say how important it is. So the more people in Southern California and Arizona that want to either speak to their legislature about the economic or the air quality issues, or that are just lovers of wildlife and birds, need to talk to people and say, this is important to us. We need to have Prop 1 money, for instance, allocated to the Salton Sea. And we need to have a long-range funding program.
There you go. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Bruce Wilcox with the Imperial Irrigation District about the future of the Salton Sea. Bruce, I'm going to let you have the last word here. What else would you like our listeners on KNSJ to know that we haven't already mentioned?
I think the thing to do, or the thing that the listeners should know, is that we need to keep the visibility up. We need to move forward with restoration programs. We need to have funding to do that. I think the other thing, though, quite honestly, that we need to do is manage expectations a little bit. It's very difficult to imagine the Salton Sea returning to what it was in the 1950s and 60s. But we can have a recreational lake at the Salton Sea, I think, and we can have habitat at the lake, and we can mitigate the air quality problems at the lake if we just can all get both the state and the federal government pulling in the same direction we are. And we've made a lot of progress in that in the last year, and I'm very confident that we're going to make some more. We've got people in our offices, for instance, that work all the time on this. They're some of the brightest people I've ever met, Jessica Lovecchio, Kelly Bishop, and others. And if they can't solve this problem, nobody can.
Very good. I want to thank you so much, Bruce, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County features lots of community concerts, from jazz in a lavender field to blues in a park, plus the Descanso Days Parade and more.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including Pine Valley Days, outdoor movies, off-road madness, and Jimmy Johnson Night in El Cajon.
So stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more. Can you say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious? Christian Community Theater San Diego celebrates its 35th anniversary at the beautiful Mount Helix Park Amphitheater with this summer's production of Mary Poppins. Enjoy an evening with everyone's favorite nanny from July 9th through August 2nd. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit cctsandiego.org.
The 46th annual Descanso Days annual parade and fair will roll out on July 11th at 10 a.m. on Viejos Grade in Descanso. Sponsored by the Descanso Town Hall Association, the parade features a flyover by the vintage World War II aircraft fighter planes from Gillespie Field, followed by a parade with vintage cars and tractors, horses and riders, and more. After the parade, the Just Friends Bluesgrass Band will perform, followed by the Nitro Express Western Band. The day's festivities will also include dancing contests, children's games, and Western reenactments by the Grand Ladies of the Old West, ending at 6 p.m. For more information, visit DescansoTownHall.org.
Gregory Page will perform live in concert at Keys Creek Lavender Farm in Valley Center on Saturday, July 11th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. Page is the 2012 winner of the San Diego Music Awards for his jazz album, Shine, 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 reminiscent of the 1920s sweet jazz era. For reservations or tickets, visit KCLFarms.com.
Rhinestone Grannies will bring a spirited performance of dance, song, and comedy to the Fletcher Hills Branch Library on Garfield Avenue in El Cajon on Saturday, July 11th at 2 p.m. They are a group of grandmothers who share a love of entertaining. They believe in health, fitness, and fun. Their purpose is to share their talent through dance, comedy, and song to enrich not only their own lives, but to encourage their audience to embrace each day as a gift. The entire troupe's ages range from 65 to 82. For more information, visit sdcl.org.
La Mesa's concerts at 6 this Sunday, July 12th, will feature Live by Breezin. The free concert starts at 6 p.m. in Harry Griffin Park at 9515 Milden Street, La Mesa, behind Grossmont High School. Now for a preview of coming attractions.
Cajon Classic Cruises will feature Off-Road Madness and a full street closure on Wednesday, July 15th. Off-roaders will be revving up from 5:30 to 8 p.m. down Main Street in downtown El Cajon. For details, visit downtownelcajon.com.
Santee hosts a blues and barbecue concert at the Town Center Community Park East, 550 Park Center Drive, on Thursday, July 16th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. The community concert will feature Whitney Shea and the Robin Henkel Band, followed by Lee Rainey and the Midnight Players.
Grossmont Center in La Mesa at Grossmont Center Drive invites you to enjoy a free movie under the moonlight. Madagascar will be showing on July 17th at 7:30 p.m. in the courtyard. Bring a comfy chair for the show, which starts at dusk around 7:30 or 8 p.m.
El Cajon will host Jimmy Johnson Night during his Cajon Classic Cruises on Wednesday, July 22nd from 5:30 to 8 p.m., honoring the five-time NASCAR champion and hometown hero. See downtownelcajon.com for more information.
Lemon Grove's Summer Concert Series will present AM Forever on Thursday, July 23rd. This free community concert will be held in the Berry Street Park at 7071 Mount Vernon Street, Lemon Grove, from 6:30 to 8 p.m.
Big Hero will be the featured film at Lemon Grove's next movie in the park on Friday, July 24th. The showing will begin at dark in the Berry Street Park, 7071 Mount Vernon Street in Lemon Grove.
The Mountain Empire Men's Club will present Pine Valley Days on July 24th and 25th. This Mountain Town's annual summer event includes a parade rolling out on July 25th at 9 a.m., plus other activities, both days at the Pine Valley Park on Old Highway 80 in Pine Valley. The fun begins with a deep pit barbecue dinner on Friday night with live music and dancing under the stars to Barbed Wire, the North American Country Music Association International's new Country Band of the Year for 2015, and other entertainers. There will also be a craft village, a free music festival, a kids zone, foods from local vendors, and more. For details, visit pinevalleydays.com.
The Stony Bee Blues Band will perform at a free concert on July 26th at Harry Griffin Park in La Mesa, 9550 Milden Street at 6 p.m. It's all part of La Mesa's Concerts at 6 Summer Music Series.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Paula Margulies, award-winning author of the historical novel Favorite Daughter, Part 1. She's also written the novel Coyote Heart and a short story collection called Face Value, Collected Stories. My guest is also a contributor to Author Magazine, the San Diego Examiner, and the Writer's Edge. She owns and runs Paula Margulies Communications, a public relations firm for authors and artists. Welcome, Paula. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's begin with your new novel, Favorite Daughter, Part 1. This is the Pocahontas story, but it's told from her perspective. What prompted you to tell such a well-known and iconic story from the Native American point of view, instead of from John Smith's?
Well, you know, I wrote my first novel, which was set here in San Diego, a contemporary novel, and it was called Coyote Heart, and it was set on the Paula Indian Reservation. So it had a Native American story to it, a theme to it. Mm-hmm. And finished that novel and decided, you know, I was going to write a sequel to it or something similar. And at that time, I happened to read a book by Sina Jeter Naslin, a historical novel called Abundance, which was about Marie Antoinette, the life of Marie Antoinette. And she told the story from her point of view, rather than the traditional history right. we've heard about the French Revolution and let them eat cake and all of that.
Right.
She let Marie Antoinette tell her version of what happened. And she was 14 years old when she was first brought to France to marry this king. And it was fascinating. And just to hear that first person voice and get that sure. female perspective on history, I thought, oh, I want to do that. Uh-huh. So I thought, okay, who would I write about? And I've always been interested in Pocahontas. I grew up here in California where we learned, you know, California history in fourth grade when we visited the missions and all of that. So I didn't really know the Pocahontas story. And when I started to read her story, I read both the John Smith version of history, some of his writing, some of the historians that were out there, Massacre and Helen Rountree. And then I came across some Native American tellings of her story. And the one that was most interesting to me was written by Dr. Linwood Costello, who's a Mattaponi Indian, and with the help of Angela Daniel, who is also Mattaponi. And their version of her story was, he claimed, handed down through oral tradition, 400 years of oral tradition, and his version was very different than the John Smith version. And I thought, oh, here's the story I'd like to tell. And I'd like to let her tell it just
right.
the way Naslin did in her book. So that's how the whole thing came about.
So it's really like uncovering the real story.
Yeah.
And I know that it's this one, the story of Pocahontas, from her point of view, that it's darker than the version that we're familiar with. Tell us about that. How did your research lead you to this darker version? And why do you think it hasn't made its way into popular storytelling until now?
That's a great question. You know, I think so much of history has a male perspective. I think in this case, John Smith wrote quite a bit about his time in the colonies, and that's because the Virginia Company of London had hired him to come to the new land and find, you know, this, you know, gold and whatever other natural resources they were looking for. And so a lot of his writing was, I think his purpose was to make himself look good and to make the colonists
right.
look good and to make the venture look successful. So the focus was more, I think, on that perspective. And I think the natives that they met along the way were incorporated into his version of the story in order to show him in a good light. Well, when you read the native version of the story, according to Dr. Costello, it's much darker. Gosh, when she first met John Smith, she was 11 years old. She was a young girl. So the romanticized version of the relationship between her and Smith, he was 27 when he came in 1607 to the colony. Yeah, so there's a huge age gap there. I, in my imagination and from what I've read in history, I think they were very good friends. I think they were fascinated with each other, mm-hmm. but she was a very young girl. And so, according to Costello, there never was that romantic relationship. But there was a political reason for her to be involved, in that her father saw that she had this, you know, kind of friendship with Smith, and he kind of used that. In fact, she was kind of used by all the men in her life, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of the story,
yeah.
is kind of the betrayal and the, just the way she figured in the history. But according to Costello, it was very dark. She was abducted, which is a known fact in history, after she married Kokoam, and there is dispute over whether he even existed. But for those historians who say she was married to this native, Kokoam. She lived in his village, and his uncle was the chief of the tribe, and the uncle conspired with the colonists for the abduction. They were the ones who actually lured her onto the onboard ship, and her father did not rescue her. I mean, they kind of held her for ransom, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And I think that broke her heart in a lot of ways. And so according to Dr. Costello, when she converted to Christianity, this was coerced. She was held there against her will. According to him, she was raped by the governor of the colony at the time, Thomas Gates. And in fact, he claims that the marriage to John Rolfe, she later married a colonist, that that marriage was coerced and that the child that she had with Rolfe was actually from the rape. And that's what the child's name is, Thomas. So according to the oral wow. tradition, yeah. this all happened. And at the end of her story, she eventually, you know, married John Rolfe and became kind of a figurehead in England, very well known as kind of a celebrity, and they mm-hmm. brought her over later to England. She met the king and queen, and she later connected with John Smith, who had left in 1609. He burned his thigh in a gunshot incident. I don't know if gunpowder went off in a boat or something. Mm-hmm. He burned himself. He decided he had to go back to England to take care of that, and he never came back. And she was devastated by that. In fact, when she went to Jamestown right after he left and said, where is he? They told her that he had died. So when she eventually was brought to England, she ran into him, and a lot of historians have documented this. So they did meet, and she's very angry with him when she met him. But on the way home from that voyage, the traditional history is that she developed a case of pneumonia and she died. She's 21 years old. She only lived for 10 years. But the Mattaponi Indians, Dr. Costello, in his version, he claims that she was murdered, that she was poisoned. And so it's just a different kind of perspective on the whole thing right. and how, you know, what her life was really like.
And it really makes us look at, you know, when we judge history by the story that we're handed, we don't always see it from the perspective of the details of the person involved. If she was 11 years old and she was exploited, it puts a whole different light on everything.
It does. It does. And she was an amazing person. I mean, I imagine her as someone who was fascinated with these foreigners, who was fascinated with the idea of another world, sure. who wanted to see that world. Also, she's very astute. She was good at the language, at learning the English language. And I think her father saw that in her, and that's mm-hmm. why she kind of became a conduit between the colonists and the tribes. Sure. And so she played an amazing role in history. At the same time, she was kind of used.
Right.
and so it's kind of interesting just to see that native perspective.
Yeah. A gifted, curious young woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a young girl, I should say, in the beginning. How about you? Are you Native American heritage?
I am not. I'm full-blooded Italian, both okay. sides. Although my father was always interested in Native history and Native artifacts, so I kind of grew up mm-hmm. with, you know, a respect for Native culture and traditions mm-hmm. and music and art. And he was very much into that. He passed away a year ago, and so that was something I grew up with that. So I've always had that interest.
So you've crossed cultures as well.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Now, let's go back to Pocahontas. She's from this native world where strangers appear in the shore of her village. When you were doing your research and you were learning about that lost world, can you share with us any details that really struck with you that you hadn't heard about previously that you think are the most telling of what life was like back then?
That's a good question. You know, as I imagine it, at the time when John Smith and the colonists first appeared in the New World, the Native American tribes there had encountered the Spaniards. They've already been visited by other European cultures, and mm-hmm. those were not good encounters. And I think my sense from the history and what I've read is that they could tell that they were facing change, that these people that were coming now more often and more, that was one of their concerns when John Smith landed. Are there more? Are you going to live here? Are you, you know, what are you doing here? And as the supply vessels kept coming, they realized that these people are not going to go away. And there was some mm-hmm. dispute among the tribe as to what to do. Chief Powhatan was friendly. He was curious about them, willing to trust them, but his interest was to have them help him fight the Spaniards if they ever return. His brother, Opechancanough, also a chief, was not open to having them there and didn't want any kind of relationship with them. So there was a lot of, I think within the tribe, a lot of division and kind of disagreement over what to do. So I think it brought in a time of it was tumultuous and mm-hmm. kind of frightening and it kind of sad because I think some of the natives there realized as more and more of the colonists arrived that their culture was going to change. And
yeah.
So it was a time of big change.
They saw the end coming, really.
They started to. Yeah, they started to. It was hard to accept, you know, and I think that led to a lot of mistakes in terms of the relationship and how they negotiated for themselves. And,
right.
Yeah, so it was interesting. And the world itself was, it was interesting writing this book because when I wrote my first book, that was a contemporary novel, mm-hmm. which was so easy to write in comparison to this historical because here in modern day, you can get in the car and go anywhere. You can take
sure.
a plane. You can ride a bus. You can be in another country in a day. Back then, all the travel was on foot or by canoe, and that was it. So in writing that story, I realized how focused they were on the area they lived in and how much the natural world mattered to them because of that. This was the world they knew. And so setting a scene, you know, trying to transition scenes or make scenes appear in different places was tough because they didn't go anywhere. You know, this 11-year-old girl was heavily guarded. If she did go to Jamestown, in my book she does. A lot of people went with her. It was a full-day journey on foot. You know, that was the kind of thing you had to deal with. So in the setting itself was kind of limiting in some way, writing the historical. So mm-hmm. the challenge was to try and make different scenes happen in different areas within the village or within the forested area around them or within near Jamestown or on these rivers. But that's kind of the location issue you're dealing with in a historical. So it's different. You kind of
right.
very focused in on the landscape and the natural world, which is so important to the culture. So there's kind of a sadness in a sense too to mm-hmm. see that, you know, the colonists came looking for natural resources. So, there was a lot of exploitation in that sense too. So it's kind of a sad time,
right.
time of change.
And when you were writing the book to immerse yourself in the mood of all that world, did you listen to music? Did you?
Oh. I burn incense when I write. It's okay. always been my, as soon as I light that incense and I smell it, it's time to settle down and write.
It brings you back.
So, but I've always felt it's really important to have sensory detail in the writing,
mm-hmm.
Touches and smells and mm-hmm. all of that. So you kind of have to imagine the setting because we're not on the East Coast here. And then write that into the story. And I think if you know your character well, you can kind of see it through her eyes and sense that world. And if you really immerse yourself in it and let her speak through you,
right.
you kind of, you have access to all of that.
Great point. Well, I know that in addition to writing and researching, you also market and promote other authors. What would you like to tell all those writers out there who envision a story and dream of making it come to life? Is it the sensory details, doing your research? Any advice for the writers out there?
I think the most important element of writing a story like this, or any story, is to really feel your characters, to immerse yourself in your characters, especially your main character. I think you have to know what she wants, what she longs for, what her dreams are, what her fears or hopes, mm-hmm. What she loves, what she hates. You have to have a deep, deep sense of who she is to write her story, especially if you're telling it in first person. You know, from a perspective of history, you have to have that. If you don't have that, I think you'd be lost. So I think that's the most important thing is to really feel the character, immerse yourself in character. And then those sensory details, to me personally, I just find that to be the most excruciatingly hard and important part of writing because I think you have to put the reader in the scene and have the reader see what she's seeing and what she's feeling and what she can touch and smell and hear. So yes, those sensory details are all part of it. And if it's happened in the past or if it's in an area you don't know well, you have to research that area. If there, you know, if there's nature involved or elements involved, you have to know the timing for those and what animals are in those areas.
Right.
And you have to understand all of that too. So
do your homework.
Yeah, getting the sensory detail down and doing the homework, but mostly immersing yourself in the character. So after a while, you hear her voice in your head and she speaks. I mean, you start to feel like you're channeling
right.
that person and
Wonderful.
She's writing her story. And then it's true. I think then at that point, mm-hmm. the character takes over and the writer just gets out of the way, kind
right.
of.
Wonderful. One last question, Paula.
Yes.
What book is next, and when can we expect to see it?
Well, as you know, this is part one of her story. So this book focuses mainly on John Smith's arrival in the colony and some of the coming of age experiences that she has as an 11-year-old girl who's maturing, who's betrothed to be married, who's the daughter of a chief. So all of those events in her life are kind of captured in part one. Part two, the story picks up after John Smith leaves. She marries Kokoam. She's abducted. And then that part of the story happens next. So I'm writing part two right now. And it's going to take a couple of years, I think, to get that written and polished up. And then I have an idea for another novel later on. That one will be set in Hawaii. It takes place in Molokai in the time of Father Damien. So that's kind of cooking in the back burner right now. But I'm focused on part two right now of this story.
And I know you have some events coming up.
I do. Yeah. November is National Native American Heritage Month. So I've been asked to speak at 5 of the local libraries here in San Diego.
Great.
The first appearance will be on November 8th at the Community University Branch Library at 12:30. And the following Saturday, the 15th, I'll be at the Pacific Beach Taylor Branch Library at 12:30. The following Tuesday, November 18th, I'll be at the Claremont Branch Library at 6:30 p.m., so that'll be an evening talk. And then the last day of appearances is November 22nd, and I'll be at two libraries that day. In the morning, at 12 o'clock noon, I'll be at the Rancho Penasquitos Branch Library, and then at 2 o'clock, I'll be appearing at the Oceanside Branch Library. And at that event, there will be powwow drummers from 1 to 2 p.m., and then I'll speak from 2 to 3, and then the library is offered to have some food trucks, some Native food brought in, so that will be a whole Native American event.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah, highlighting the month, so
great.
That'll be the final kickoff on the 22nd.
Well, Paula, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
For more information on Paula Margulies, her work, and her blog, please visit her website at paulamargulies.com, and that's spelled PAULAMARGULIES. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Jim Brister, KNSJ News, with news about an East County church that's mounting a food drive July 8th through 28th to help Mama's Kitchen deliver nutritious meals to men, women, and children with HIV or AIDS. Mama's Kitchen also provides nutrition education and services to its clients through a program called Mama's Pantry. The Table United Church of Christ of La Mesa is asking the public to give non-perishable food items such as canned tuna, chili, salmon, and soup, canned fruits, peanut butter and jelly, spaghetti sauce, boxed cereals, and dry milk. You can deliver non-perishable foods to the church at 11 a.m. on Sundays or call 464-1519 for other drop-off hours July 8th through July 28th. The church is located at 5940 Kelton Avenue in La Mesa. For more information, you can visit the church's website at tableucc.com or Mama's Kitchen's website at mamaskitchen.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.